The Apostle Peter is writing to people who are going through difficulties, going through times that could lead to despair, and writing to them who are saying, you know, I thought we were the sons of God, and the whole world's against us. We're suffering. We've been chased out of our country. We're vagabonds. We're pilgrims and strangers just in this different area. And people don't know us. They don't like us. Here we are. Peter is saying, God is paying attention and will sort it all out. But that will be in his time and not necessarily yours. In our passage, 2 Peter 2, 4 through 9, I found that I had to include this whole thing because it's one basic, although larger thought. Let me explain this to you by saying, first of all, what he's saying is, let me tell you a lesson from God's history. And we look at the first part of verse 4 and then jump right on over to verse 9. The concept is, for if God did these things, then the Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptations, first, and secondly, to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. God knows these things. Now, in investigating these words, I found that the word know uses the word for knowledge that emphasizes a clear and mental perception rather than a learning by practical experience. What this means then is that God did not have to practice these things to learn how to obtain his goal. We would have guessed that anyway, God being who he is. God clearly understood this from the beginning. So I realized when he says, for if God did things like this, then he knows how to deliver the godly and to reserve the unjust unto judgment. What it's speaking about here is not he learned this by experience, but this is his nature. This is his character. This is something that he knows internally. And it's his nature and his character that taught him how to carefully discriminate in judgment. The verb is in the perfect tense, showing a completed state of knowledge. He knoweth. He stands knowing. It gives us this meaning. For if God is of such a nature and character to do these things, then he, and the word Lord doesn't have the definite article, it means he who has the character of Lord, he, acting in the character of Lord and Master, perfectly understood how to deliver the godly and to keep the unjust for punishment. And A.T. Robertson, the old Greek scholar, tells us that this greatly interrupted phrase is a condition of the first class in Greek, meaning that it is assumed as true that if God did this, then he knows, and he does. It gives us the meaning that if God acted in these consistent patterns of behavior, he certainly knows how to deliver and reserve for judgment. God has not lost track. You have not been swept in some bywater and forgotten. The trials, the difficulties that you're going through, he says, God is paying close attention and he will make it right. He is so careful in his discrimination between the godly and the ungodly, so careful in this that he chooses, God leads Peter to describe three events from the Old Testament. And I'm going to try to keep moving through this because it ends up that these three have a lot to tell us and a lot to cover, especially this first one. But what we see then is that it was a matter of character and a matter of discrimination. Discrimination, of course, in times of racial discrimination is a bad word, but it's defined as the ability to understand that one thing is different from another. So that's the way I'm using it here. God's careful discrimination God's careful analysis of things to distinguish one from the other. We see his careful handling of the godly to deliver the godly out of temptations. This word deliver, the word has its first meaning as to draw to oneself. This is pulling somebody out of the water, you know. This is that kind of deliverance, that kind of rescue, drawing to oneself. And it came to mean to rescue. Jesus used this word to teach us to ask God to deliver us from evil. That's the word. Paul used the word to describe both his physical rescue from persecutions, and also he speaks of our salvation that delivered us from the wrath to come. So God knows how to deliver. And then he says the godly. The word is literally good worshiper. Not a word we would have thought of was the implication here. But this word, good worshiper, was used to distinguish the worshiper of the true God from the worshiper of pagan gods, of the idols. And so Peter uses a word here that pictures someone worshiping the true and living God. And then the word temptations. It's the word that means first a trial that puts something or someone to the test. That's what the word means. And it came to refer to any trial, any problem, but also then to temptations given by the devil to urge people to sin. Now, James, in his epistle, writes using this word to encourage us to count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations. And why? Because blessed is the man that endureth temptations, that gets through the trial. We often are concerned about getting out of the problem. God is more interested in us learning the reason that he gave us the difficulty. He put us through a trial, a testing time, for us to learn something. The strange thing is, if we even are successful in delivering ourselves out of it, we don't learn the lesson, God says, well, I gotta do it again. I gotta give you another trial. Gotta give you another lesson. So, this is the idea. And I want you to be clear about this. He's talking to people undergoing trial. He is not saying God knows how to keep you from ever having a problem. I suppose God does, but that would be counterproductive to what God wanted to do in your life. You see? That's why James says, count it all joy. God's doing something with you. Wow, I've got a problem. Okay, let's find out what God's doing. We can get excited about this, you see. Adam Clark says this, we should carefully observe, one, that the godly man is not to be preserved from temptation. We're not isolated from it. Secondly, that he will be preserved in temptation. It's while you're in the temptation you're being preserved. And thirdly, he will be delivered out of it. So enduring it until God says, you've learned that lesson, I deliver you out of it. And there's no problem so difficult that God can't get you out of it. All right. Then he mentions his careful handling of the unjust to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. This idea of reserving, it's the word that means to keep, and it's in the present tense, to keep continually. And this kind of keeping emphasizes watchful care and is suggestive of present possession. This is keeping something close to watch it carefully. God knows to keep careful watch over the ungodly. He's paying close attention to this. The unjust, this is just like our English word, the negative of just, the negative of the right kind of person. And then unto the day of judgment. This is literally into day belonging to judgment. And this is the word for judgment that actually speaks of separation. We'll talk about that in a little more detail in a moment. Not the day, but day. That a day that's characterized by judgment, by separating. And then that day of judgment will lead them to be punished. This is literally being cut off. It's the word that's used for pruning back plants, being cut off. The present tense indicates the continuity of the punishment, the continuing nature of the punishment. They will be given to continuing being cut off. It's interesting to me to see this word being used for punishment. We often don't think of that as being punishment, that we just are cut off from something, you know. No more ice cream, we're cut off. My diagnosis of diabetes, cut off from dessert. I don't want to think of that as punishment, deliverance. but here, this concept of the word being punished is being cut off. And in the ultimate sense, hell is being cut off from God. The God who has been so kind to you, so full of care, as Charles Weigel presented to us in the song, who watched over you every day of your life, gave you every opportunity, urged you with the gospel, and you continued to turn away from him. Finally, God says, well then, since that's what you have asked for, I give it to you, and you are cut off. But to be cut off from God is to be cut off from life, and to be cut off from light, and to be cut off from love. And so hell is a place of darkness and despair and death. So, judgment to being cut off. Well, then he gives three examples from God's history of how he was carefully able to separate the godly from the ungodly. Example one, the malcontent angel whoremongers. This is supposing that you come to the same conclusion I did about this. God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto judgment. To me, the interesting thing about this is we either take this for what it says, or we say it's just some sort of odd general concept that we have to, you know, make up something else about it. I take it for what it says. With that, this is something that he did, something in the past that he did. Now, we recognize this is not the normal situation with fallen angels. They're not in hell. They're out roaming around, doing mischief, doing bad things, demon possession stuff. So this is a different situation. These were a different group of angel sinners. Angels. God does not use here the definite article, so it emphasizes this was even angels. Even angels are not exempt from God's judgment, reserving them for judgment. One of the fallen angels, we have an interesting passage in Job where one of the fallen angels appears to Eliphaz, and when you listen to his words, you begin to hear this concept. He even found fault with angels. How much more is he going to find with man, you see? And that's really the emphasis that Peter is giving here. And he comes trying to imply that he is a holy angel, talking about Job. But let me just share that with you. Eliphaz tells his friends of his experience. Now a thing was secretly, and Hebrew is by stealth, as you know, stealthily, brought to me, and mine ear received a little thereof. In thoughts from the vision of the night, when deep sleep falleth on men, fear came upon me, fear met me, and trembling, which made all, that is the multitude of my bones, shake. Then a spirit passed before my face. The hair of my flesh stood up. You sense how creepy this is? It's in the dark. It's all creepy. It stood still, but I could not discern the form thereof. An image was before mine eyes. There was silence, and I heard a voice, for I heard a still voice saying. A creepy thing. Now, every other time when a holy angel comes, what is his first words to the people who see this supernatural being? Fear not. Fear not. This one doesn't say that. The demon gives his message of hurt to Job, and he's trying to spoil the minds and hearts of his counseling friends. So it goes on. Here's what this vision said. Shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his maker? Behold, he put no trust in his servants, and his angels he charged with folly. Or the King James margin says, or not in his angels in whom he put light. He didn't even trust them. He's kind of, you know, pouting. He even cast us out. Oh, I didn't mean to say us. How much less in humans? How much less in them that dwell in houses of clay? Your little clay houses. Whose foundation is in the dust, which are crushed before the moth. Oh, a moth landed on you and you were crushed. They are destroyed, that is, beaten in pieces. You see the disdain here of humanity. From morning to evening, they perish forever without any regarding it. Doth not their excellency, which is in them, go away? They die even without wisdom. You hear this picture, and this fallen angel on the receiving end of God's judgment says he even found fault with his angels. And that's really the point that this illustration is given to us. Now it says that these are the angels that sinned. This verb is the normal word for sin. It pictures missing the mark. Not just missing the mark, but hitting the wrong mark. You know, if I'm aiming at the target bullseye and I hit the cow in the field, I've hit the wrong thing. That's what sin is. This is the normal word in the Greek for sin. It is used as a participle, meaning the having sinned angels. Jude gives us the parallel passage and indicates the detail of the sin involved. So Jude 6, the first part of the verse says, and the angels which, instead of saying sinned, they kept not their first estate and left their own habitation. Let me just say, I'm going to have to go through this quickly because there's a lot to cover here. But I did not come to this conclusion easily. I was brought to this screaming and dragging my feet. I didn't want to hold to this, but I feel that the scripture forces me into this. So this is not a frivolous thing that I'm sharing with you, even though I can't give you all the research. So they kept not their first estate. This means they did not carefully attend, that's the word kept, they did not carefully attend to their beginning or origin. They were not content to stay in their original place or purpose. That's why I called them malcontent. Secondly, they left their own habitation. This word habitation means they deserted, abandoned, left their dwelling place. Now, this word for habitation is used in only one other place in the New Testament. It is 2 Corinthians 5:2. For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed upon with our house, our habitation, which is from heaven. Now, to sum up, what this tells us is that this house in 2 Corinthians 5:2 refers to our spiritual body. When we are, when our body is in the tomb and our spirit has been taken to heaven, is what Paul is talking about to the Corinthians, we're a free spirit. We're an unclothed spirit. He actually uses the term, we desire to be clothed upon. And what is it we're desiring? We want to be clothed upon, not with the body that, you know, the old body that we had, but the new body, the resurrected body, the improved body, your body 2.0. You know, it's the one, the improved version of it that's geared to last forever. Nothing ever getting sick or breaking or falling down or getting old. So it refers to our spiritual body. The angels then deserted their spiritual body. So this is not the same sin as those who fell with Satan. We are told of that fall very generally in Revelation 12, 3 and 4. There appeared, John is up in heaven viewing this, he's in the spirit viewing this, there appeared another wonder or sign in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads, 10 horns, 7 crowns upon his head, and in general this is Satan. His tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven. Stars is one of those interesting parallels to angels. He drew 1/3 of the stars of heaven, did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman that was ready to be delivered for to devour her child as soon as it was born. That's the woman is Israel and the child to be born is Christ. Now, Satan here, pictured as a red dragon, the tail brings 1/3 of the angels down. That was the fall. These fallen angels became the devil's angels. Revelation 12, 7, there was war in heaven. We're still in Revelation 7, still the same context. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon fought and his angels. So these became the demons, these are the demon angels. These fallen angels are not kept in prison. See, we understand that. They're allowed to roam free with the promise of incarceration at a later time. Matthew 8, 29, Christ confronts demons that are demon-possessing a person, and they cry out. They recognize Jesus. They knew him back when they were not fallen. You know, he created them. They know him. And behold, they cried out, saying, "What have we to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of God? Art thou come hither to torment us before the time?" Here they were, free-roaming demons, and they knew the time was coming, but they knew this wasn't the time. And so they're expecting this incarceration later. Matthew 25, 41, what is that punishment? Well, then he will say to them on the left hand, "Depart from me, you cursed, into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels." And that's the lake of fire. That's Gehenna, that's hellfire. Now, where will they be kept before the fire? Their place of expected incarceration is the pit, the abyss. Luke 8, 31, they besought him, these are demons again talking to him, they besought him that he would not command them to go out into the deep. Well, it ends up that this word deep is the Greek word abyssos, abyssos. That's our word abyss, the pit. This is the same word that's used in the book of the Revelation, translated bottomless pit rather than deep. So they're expecting eventually to be taken and put into this pit, but from there brought out and sent into the fire. It's where Satan will be held during the millennial kingdom. So who are these angels? These are the ones that sinned. And they were put, cast down to hell, he says. Who are these? My conclusion is this. These are the angels that sinned by mating with human women. You say, wow, I missed that part. Well, there it is in Genesis 6, verses 2 and 4. That the sons of God, this is a phrase referring to the angels. In Job, it's used of the angels. That the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and took them wives of all which they chose. As a result of that, verse 4 says, there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. You can imagine, giants, they were the super men, they were the tank of the army, you know. And he says this came about by this union. Now we find that the issue of the mating was giants. It's the word, the strong, if you have your strong concordance with you, probably not, strong concordance, number 5306, if you wanted to look it up, Nephil. Interesting that it's translated giants, but it comes from the root word, Strong's 5307, meaning to fall. This word means the fallen ones. Isn't that interesting? The children born to these fallen angels were fallen themselves. They were genetically different from normal men by size, enormity of size. One notable giant mentioned he had 6 fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each foot. And then it says it happened in those days, in Genesis, in those days, referring to the days just before Noah's flood wiped them all out. So there shouldn't have been any more giants. But it happened again after that, also after that, means it happened again, which explains how giants came to exist in the post-flood world. So here's the thing. The idea of angelic form taking on the form of a human, mating with a woman, and creating some sort of monstrosity. This is what was going on. This is why they were not allowed to continue to roam free. This was a sin that God carefully restricted and grabbed them up, put them in solitary confinement. He isolated them. They would not do this again. Now, this phrase, cast down to hell, but cast them down to hell. I was asked one time as a young student, we were talking about hell, Gehenna, Hades, the temporary place of torment. And somebody says, well, have you heard of Tartarus? I said, no, isn't that something on your teeth? You know, and, no, this is something else. This refers to a place that is not Gehenna, the lake of fire, nor is it Hades, the place of the dead. It is Tartarus. This is the Greek word, Tartarus. Now, as Hades was used in Greek mythology to refer to the place of the dead, Tartarus was used to refer to a prison for the gods. And so it becomes an appropriate approximation of the truth. They said that Tartarus was as far below the surface of the earth as the surface of the earth was below heaven. It is not a noun here, but a participle verb. Cast down to hell, that's one word, and it means they were Tartarized. They were Tartarists. They were cast into this place of Tartarus. So a strange concept here. We're talking about these were put aside in a special prison, and it says that he delivered them into chains of darkness. Delivered here has the concept of committing them, literally to turn them out. So it was used to describe Jesus being delivered to Pilate, and of Pilate delivering him to the crucifixion, committing him to that place. They were committed to this prison. And then chains of darkness. This place must be understood as a place of confinement, or at least restriction, because of the concept of chains. That's what chains are for, right? Compare this description of these fallen demons with Satan's confinement in the abyss, Revelation 20, verses 1 to 3, and then verse 7. I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit, the abyss, and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him with the chain 1,000 years. Cast him into the bottomless pit, the abyss, shut him up, closed the door, set a seal upon him that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled. After that, he must be loosed a little season. All right. So this is where he's put, and it's with a chain. And it's closed up. It's in a pit, closed up. Sounds like chains of darkness. Verse 7, when the 1,000 years were expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison. This pit now is called a prison, a place of confinement. So Jude, our parallel passage here in verse 6, the second part, hath reserved in everlasting chains under darkness. It's interesting to me, think of spirit beings, you know, like the devil. There exists, or at least will exist, chains, God chains, that are capable of restraining spirit beings. I guess they exist now because this happened before. And right now they're down there in this pit, chained. This is well beyond our ability to grasp. But the purpose of such restriction is to keep them away from hurting humanity. The demons, as bad as they are, the normal demons, they're allowed to do their work. God's going to use them, their trials, their temptations, to better you and I. This, he's not going to allow. So they're taken out of circulation. They're put in Tartarus. They're chained. They're sealed in darkness. Darkness here is an interesting word that's used only four times, but only in the two parallel passages, 2 Peter and Jude. It's talking about this very thing. It is translated darkness twice and mist once and blackness once. So you get the idea. The word originally meant the gloom of twilight, as the sun sets, just getting gloominess. Classical Greek applied it to the darkness of the underworld. And this is picturing the gloom of a sunless region. And that seems to be precisely how it's used here in 2 Peter and in Jude. So that is the particular darkness that these chains keep them in. All right. Now, with all of that, recognize that what Tartarus is not their punishment. That's just where they're being kept. They are reserved for judgment. That's what they're there for. They're being reserved. They're being kept for punishment. So reserved here in a condition of being carefully watched into judgment. And this is the word for separation. Tartarus then, like Hades, is not eternal. It's a temporary holding place until the judgment. Jude says, unto the judgment of the great day. I assume that this must be the great white throne judgment that's described in Revelation 20, 11 to 15, which we won't take the time to go there. We're taking so much time with this already. The point being this, that it's during that time that sinners are judged, that sinners, the unsaved are judged. They're there because they're unsaved. And then the book of life is opened. He says, well, not found in the book of life anymore. And so they're cast into the lake of fire. What we find here, evidently, is that also the demons and Satan are cast in at this time. So we understand that even though it's only humans talked about in Revelation 20, if we consider that Satan and his demons are active at the very end of the millennial reign, and right after that is the great white throne judgment, we understand that they were active right until that time. After that, they're not active. So those that are condemned at the great white throne judgment are cast into Gehenna, the lake of fire, and that's the very place, you remember, that was designed for the devil and his angels. That's the place that they were supposed to go. So we conclude that the judgment of the spirit beings also happens there. Now, one last point before we leave this, and the others are so much simpler to understand. We understand that, though not specifically stated, there was a sparing. He says he didn't spare the angels that sinned. This implies that he did spare the angels that did not sin. He was making a careful discrimination between the two. God was careful to spare those who did not sin. And in the next two examples of God's judgment, this sparing will be more emphasized. So quickly, let's move on to the second example, number two, the malignant ancient world. He says here, and he spared not the old world, but saved Noah, the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly. He calls this the old world cataclysm. Spared not the old world, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly. Old world, the word world doesn't have the definite article. It's not the old world. It's the world characterized by being old. And this word old is kind of interesting. It is the word that means primal, the beginning. So this is the primal human society. This was the world as it was created and developed and then destroyed in the flood. Bringing in upon is one word, And it means having led upon, as though God led the flood in upon them. And the word flood, I wanted to show you this in the Greek, Strong's 2627, is kataklysmos. We get our word cataclysm from this word. And I thought that was interesting because cataclysm to us is not necessarily a flood. But that was its first meaning, inundation, being covered over. So I think cataclysm then by analysis is, by reflection, is when we are overwhelmed, as in a flood, with whatever problem. So it's used three other times in the New Testament, twice in Matthew, once in Luke, but always speaking of Noah's flood, Noah's cataclysm. Now, the world of the ungodly does not use the definite articles in the Greek, so again, emphasizing the character of the world. And this word for ungodly is just the opposite of the word for godly that he is going to be talking about, that he knows how to spare the godly. The good worshiper, you remember? These are the people that are not proper worshipers. This is the negative of that. And so these are people destitute of proper worship, that they may do whatever they want, may worship whatever they please, but they're not worshiping properly. That's the characteristic of the ungodly that were taken away by the flood. Now, consider this. This does not mean that when God saw they didn't go to proper temple worship, he said, well, I'm going to kill them. That wasn't it. They were not killed for improper worship. They had the character of those that would not worship. That's who they were. Their lives, because of this, became vicious and evil. And we can take you back to the Genesis 6 passage where it describes them. And only evil continually, every single day, only evil. And so it was they're not worshiping, they're not submitting, they're not bowing before God, the true God, that led them into lives that God says, I can't have them if any of the world's going to be spared. In fact, it was out of protective love for humanity, for future humanity, that God gave it a new start, wiped the slate clean with an overwhelming cancer. He cut that out, and it was everybody but eight people. Because he says eight person salvation, but save Noah, the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness. Noah, I thought was interesting, described in Genesis as having found grace in the eyes of the Lord, and that he walked with God. This is a description of not just somebody who walked a straight and narrow. This is talking about somebody who experienced spiritual salvation. Noah trusted God to take him to himself as a friend. When God told him, come thou and all thy house into the ark, for thee have I seen righteous before me in this generation, he was naming him righteous, a state that cannot be achieved by works. The New Testament's quite clear. You can't get there by good works. By the works of the law shall no flesh be justified, not even Noah. So he didn't get there by good works. This was a salvation experience. Well, then eighth pictures that he was one of seven others who came with him. That was he and his wife, three sons and their wives. They all found salvation in the company of Noah. Everyone alive today has come from this family of Noah. You say, well, how come we look so different? Well, the wives came in from different families. We don't even know what the different types of humanity was back in that day. But all the so-called races of today have developed from these three sons and their wives, and the wives would have brought in the genetic differences from all around. So in reality, there's one race, the human race, you see. Racial differences are kind of an evolutionary concept, not a biblical one. And then he's called a preacher of righteousness. He pictures a man, a preacher, a herald, one who proclaims the message of the king. Hear ye, crying aloud the message of righteousness. The old world was characterized by refusing to worship Jehovah God. Noah heralded the message of faith in God. And these people needed the righteousness of God, not the righteousness of men. And that's what he was heralding. We come to the third example. And this is the example of the morally abusive wicked. He says, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them with an overthrow. We'll look at that word. Making them an ensample to those, unto those that after should live ungodly. And delivered. Here's a real special emphasis. As Noah was delivered from the flood, Lot and his family was delivered. He delivered just Lot, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked, for that righteous man, dwelling among them, seeing and hearing, vexed his righteous soul from day to day with their unlawful deeds. In Jude, that parallel passage, verse 7, even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange or other flesh, are set forth for an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. They didn't suffer eternal fire at the destruction. Their souls suffered it later, and they're an example to those who will suffer that fire, eternal fire. They were condemned by catastrophe, turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes. This is literally true. Genesis 19:24. Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone. This is like sulfur and fire. Burning sulfur from the Lord out of heaven. It just fell down upon them, burned them up. After this devastation, Abraham looks toward Sodom, Genesis 19:28, and he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain, and behold, lo, the smoke of the country went up like the smoke of a furnace. This place was burned to ashes. And he condemned them with an overthrow. The word condemn is literally separated down, took them apart. Overthrow, again, Strong's 2692, we know this word, catastrophe. We get our word catastrophe from this. And interestingly, at least to me, it meant to turn over like you do in your garden. You bring the shovel over and you turn the ground over. You're catastrophing your garden. And that's what he did. The estimate that the place where Sodom and Gomorrah used to be is the Dead Sea today. When Lot looked at it before this destruction, it says that it was like the Garden of Eden, like Garden of God. It was beautiful. Today, it's a salt sea. Nothing grows right around it because the salt has killed all everything fertilized around it. So, making them an ensample to those that after should live ungodly. Interesting set of words. Setting them as a pattern to those who are about to become, like the ancient world, devoid of proper worship. This is the same word for ungodly. The people that didn't worship the true and living God. Jude 7 says they're set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. Jude reminds us that they perished under fire and brimstone. You see? And that is the very nature of Gehenna, the lake of fire, a place that burns with fire and brimstone. But he delivered from destruction, delivered just Lot, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked, and so on. Delivered means rescued. Just and righteous, translated in this verse, are the same word. Translated differently, but it's the same word. We find a condition that we didn't read about in Genesis when we were reading Lot. Lot was a righteous man. He was a saved man. He's doing all this compromising, but he was a saved man. We see his righteousness was of the heart. What happened? Vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. This word vexed means being tired down with toil, being exhausted with labor. That sin that he was living by wore him down. Filthy, usually translated lasciviousness, and it means unbridled lust, unrestricted lust. Conversation means manner of life, And wicked means one who breaks through the restraint of law and gratifies his lusts. Very specific word for wicked. My friend, the focus is upon moral wickedness that is known to us today as homosexuality. It's also called sodomy, from Sodom. Living among them, he saw and heard their sinful behavior, and it vexed what the scripture says was his righteous soul. This second word, vexed, means tormented, as the testing of metal. They put acid on metal to see its reaction. In testing metal, it's you're tormenting the metal, and this is the word. It means he never got used to it. You see, they performed unlawful deeds, and it happened day after day after day, works that were out without the law. Now, Lot was drawn to the fertile plains of Sodom, like I said, because it was like the Garden of Eden. And unlike his uncle Abraham, he did not choose to live life as a pilgrim and a stranger. He didn't just pitch his tent towards Sodom. We find that he's living in Sodom. He's sitting in the gate. He became one of the respected people. He was wealthy, so he was respected. He was dwelling among them. My friend, this is that extra thing, and I can't get into it now because of the time, but this was the extra thing that he tells us about. Here he's writing to people who are in a pagan land, and they're suffering by persecution. He says, don't be like Lot. Righteous though you are, compromising with the people around you. Don't do that. God was careful to rescue this righteous man, but his lifestyle of compromise cost him his wife, you remember? Brought her out, but she had to look back. And she died. And the spiritual discernment of his daughters? Nah. They said, oh, now everybody we've ever known is dead. So they got their father drunk, laid with him, produced children that would ever after be enemies of Israel. So here's a special lesson of life among the heathen under persecution. Stay separated in heart and life. God can rescue you. God will deliver you. He knows exactly how to do that. Three great examples. Well, I've taken more time than I should, but there we have it. And this is what Peter points to, saying these are the things you need to recognize in the midst of trial. God knows. God knows how to handle this. So let's rest it in his hands, not try to take it into our own. Let's bow for prayer. Father, you've given us an example of three times when you waded into a situation that was very bad and you very carefully discriminated. You know the hearts and souls of men and angels, and you are able to separate those who were causing such devastation and put them away. So it is with the entire world. You were not stopped because they were angels. You were not stopped because it was the bulk of the world. And in fact, you were not stopped when there was an entire city or a couple of cities that needed to be eliminated so they wouldn't hurt others. We ask, Father, that you might give us the recognition that no matter how widespread these things are, no matter how important these people are, you can take them down and, in fact, will take them down as they maintain their ungodly attitudes. But for those who are your own, you will deliver us, perhaps by death from the world itself, perhaps by eliminating the problem. But we ask, Father, that you might help us to do what this passage encourages those under persecution to do, to put our faith and trust in you, who by your very nature knows how to handle every situation. With heads bowed, eyes closed. I wonder if you'd say, well, Pastor, I'm not sure that I'm actually one of those righteous ones that God can discriminate for. I don't know that if I were to die today, I would go to heaven to be with the Lord, but I'd like to be sure. I'd like to know. I'd like to have Jesus Christ to be my Savior, my substitute for the penalty. pray for me. I'd like to know for sure that I'm a Christian, that I'm saved. Pray for me. Would you slip your hand up and say, pray for me? I'd like to know for sure. I'd like to know for sure today that if I were to die, I'd go to heaven to be with the Lord. Is there one? We'd love to pray for you. We'd love to bring your soul before the Lord. Well, then, Christian, let me ask you this. Going through the difficulties of life, has it been a temptation for you to say, God's not doing anything? God's not changing anything? Let me just encourage you to understand He's got it under control. Are you willing to rely on Him? If God will do these three things, then He knows how to deliver the godly and reserve the ungodly to judgment. Can you rest in Him? Perhaps you say, this is my prayer. I'd like to be resting in Him in the midst of trial and persecution. Pray for me. Just slip your hand up and say, pray for me. I want to rest entirely on the strength and knowledge and understanding and loving care of God. Father, then we thank You that we have this opportunity to turn our hearts to Thee, to understand that there's no situation so great You cannot handle it. No intricate differences between people that You cannot sort out. You are carefully discriminating who should be punished and who should be delivered. And we pray Thy blessing then in Jesus' name. Amen.